Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak, who is having technical difficulties, but in theory, he'll be back up at full speed here in a couple of minutes. Hey, as a reminder to those that are joining us live, make sure and join the chat room at the bottom of the show page with the usual suspects. We have Ken and Lucian in there already. Get things stirred up. If you have some observations about the show or some questions you think that we should be asking our guests or perhaps a point we missed, feel free to fold it in there at the chat room. Eagle One and I will be keeping an eye on that during the course of the show, and we'll be best to fold those ideas in as the conversation moves forward. And if you're new to Midrats or you want to catch up on some of the shows that you may have missed, you can always get the full archive over at the show page at Blog Talk Radio, or you can just subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And like we did last week, if we either have a question we really, really, really want to ask our guest, or we're just taking a couple minutes to flesh out a final point, at the 60-minute mark, if you're listening live, the show will come to an end, but it does keep recording, so we have a little bit of an after show for some of our episodes. If that happens today, you can just go over to the archive and you can catch the extra minutes afterwards. We'll try to give everybody a heads up on the chat room how many minutes we go beyond there. Now let's get on with the show. As promised in the advertisements for today's episode, last week we spent a lot of time on the Indian Ocean and we talked about the Pacific as well. And today we're going to kind of move the emphasis a little bit. We're going to focus on the Pacific and maybe tickle a little bit at the Indian Ocean while we're at it. But one thing I find fascinating about this topic is the fact that, here we are, well after World War II, where we came to dominate the Pacific. And when you go back even further with the Great White Fleet or the opening of Japan, regardless of how technology has changed, strategy, geopolitics, who's your friend, who your isn't, the realities of operating the Pacific remain the same. It's an ocean of great distances. Regardless of whether you're running on coal or you're running on nuclear power, you still have the challenges associated with feeding people, getting fuel, get equipment for sustained operations, getting arms on board. You have a lot of very diverse nations. You have critical economic links. All these things have remained the same. And for a nation that wishes to have an effect on that area, you need to have the range, you need to have the bases in order to be able to stay in there for any sustained length of time. And we find ourselves here in the second decade of the 21st century looking at these same problems in an environment of shrieking budgets, a fleet with a paucity of auxiliaries compared to what it once had, and we have a future fleet that we're building that's going to have a significant portion of them being a relatively short-range, limited-mission, shallow-water corvette that we have dubbed the Littoral Combat Ship, which will have a high reliance on underway replenishment and also bases for maintenance and support than what most successful classes of ships that have been in the Pacific have had. And for the full hour to discuss the range of challenges in the Pacific will be Robert Haddock. He is the managing editor of Small Wars Journal. He writes also This Week at War column for Foreign Policy magazine that covers current military developments, defense strategy, emergency threats, Pentagon planning, service doctrine, and other related topics. His article that we're going to use as kind of a base or a touchstone for today's episode is titled The Navy's Pacific Problem. And you can find that linked both over at the Blog Talk Radio show page, but also at my homepage. As an additional background, Robert was a U.S. Marine Corps officer, served with both the 3rd and 23rd Marine Regiments, deployed to Asia and Africa. He has advised our State Department and National Intelligence Council on strategy and irregular warfare issues. Robert, welcome to MIDRATS.
Well, it's a great honor to be here. Thanks, Sal.
Just to kind of kick things off, we know all of our properly briefed guests, I know the regulars probably have already done it. You can, again, I want to encourage everybody to go get the article we're going to use as a touchstone that you wrote called The Navy's Pacific Problem. But in general terms, what is the Navy's Pacific problem? And 67 years after it became, in many respects, an American lake, why are we still trying to solve it?
Well, that's a great question, and I hopefully by the end of this hour we'll get some even more illumination on that question, in addition to the great coverage that you've already provided on these really deep questions in your previous episodes of MIDRATS. Well, the global security environment is never a static thing; it is always changing, evolving. New powers arise, old powers decline. The situation evolves as history evolves, and the Pacific, the Indo-Pacific or Asian-Pacific theater is no exception to those long-standing laws of history. And the changing situation in the Pacific now involves the rise of China as a global power, as a military power. That's the principal change that's happening, but that's not the only change. Another trend is something I discussed in my latest column at Foreign Policy, which came out on Friday afternoon. In that column I discussed the falling price and greater dispersion of militarily relevant technology. And as the price of militarily relevant technology falls and it becomes more accessible to more players around the world, both nation states and non-state actors, we should expect the expansion of more military powers in all their different states of evolution, sizes, locations, and that will greatly complicate national security planning for powers like the United States. And the United States is a power that has had thrust on it the responsibility for policing the global commons, which includes the great sea lines of communication through the Pacific, Indian Oceans, and so forth. So that is the broad backdrop of the evolving security challenges that the U.S. faces in the Indo-Pacific region. And during the next 50 minutes, I'm sure we'll get into a lot more detail about what those challenges are.
Well, let's. Can you hear me? Okay.
I can hear you great.
Okay. Let's get into one of those challenges right now. You discussed in your foreign policy article the size of the fleet. That seems to be a rather hot topic at the moment because we keep getting different numbers rolling in and out of the Navy. What can you talk about a little bit? Expand on your thoughts in your article.
Yes. Yes, thanks. Thanks, Eagle One, for that question. The Navy has recently released its 30-year shipbuilding plan, the shipbuilding plan foresees the ship count rising from the 280 region where it is, 280-something region where it is right now, up to about 300, 298 to 300 over the, say, the next decade. There's a lot of contingencies involved, of course. But anyway, so we're talking about a roughly 300-ship Navy. the issue here is firstly whether that number of vessels is going to be sufficient to provide security in the global commons that are so vital to global commerce. We're talking here about the South China Sea, all the great sea lines of communication that pass through the Western Pacific, across the Pacific, Strait of Malacca, across the Indian Ocean, and those are the most important, but there are many, many very important ones elsewhere in the world. So can a navy of 300 ships perform that patrolling task, that security task? And then slicing down to a little bit deeper level of detail is the question about the littoral combat ship. Eventually, when that program is built out, the projection is that the Navy will purchase 55 of these ships. And so they, as Sal mentioned at the top of the program, are going to be a significant portion of the total fleet size. Are they capable ships? What role are they going to play? Are they going to inspire confidence among our allies? Are they going to provide deterrence against potential adversaries? So those are the open questions, and it's something that future Navy leaders are going to that's the hand they're going to get dealt, and that's something they're going to have to work with in the years and decades ahead.
Yeah, I kind of I use a picture. If everybody has seen the sand pebbles, and there's a great picture from the movie of the gunboat at full coal speed headed towards the blockade on the river. I kind of use that as a little snide in one of my little bits about the LCS. And then a lot of the things that we've seen in the last 9 months talking about LCS going to Singapore and its mission it's going to do, of course, is an LCS with no mission modules and really little capability outside of 57 and 30 millimeters with a little bit of self-protection from an air threat. But they're really talking about what was pre-World War II, the gunboats in the Pacific, but nobody in the 20s and the 30s ever thought about having those little gunboats be the cornerstone of the fleet. And after I did that, I was remembering as a young midshipman, one of the little light bulbs that went off in my head is when I read about the development of our fleet submarines in World War II. And as a byproduct of an understanding of the needs of the Pacific, these were large submarines for their time. They, especially when you compare it to the German boats, and as a result, because they were focused on the Pacific and the ranges, and they really were just some great, great ships for that particular theater. And that was a submarine that was developed in a large part to meet a strategy, a strategic framework that the Navy saw that it was going to have to meet in the Pacific. And the question I have for you two, just bringing the LCS into the discussion again, are we intentionally building a fleet to meet a strategic requirement, or are we building a fleet based around, in large numbers, the LCS and the LCS concept? Are we building that fleet and now we're trying to search for some type of strategy to justify and use it?
That's a great question, and I would say that sort of to sum up my foreign policy article about the Navy's challenges in the Pacific, I would say that the theme of that article is forward presence strategy. The forward presence strategy, which has been not only been a Navy strategy, it's been a government-wide or a national strategy of the United States with respect to the relationship it has with its allies and partners. The forward presence strategy is under pressure now, and the question is whether the Navy and all the defense programs and indeed the national strategy of the whole country, whether the Navy and the country will be able to formulate concepts of operations, doctrines, procurement programs, and so forth to sustain the forward present strategy in the face of the evolving threat challenges that are emerging now and will become more intense in the years ahead. And so thus, we circle back to the issue of LCS and what role will it play, if any, in a robust forward present strategy.
What about the one of the things I don't think I saw in your article was an answer to the question of how much we can rely on some of our allies in the Pacific, the South Koreans, the Japanese, the I'd say the Philippines, but since our largest ship is now a converted Coast Guard, Singapore, you know, the countries that also have share an interest in the in open access to the South China Sea and the Straits of Malacca. Is that something, and of course India, is that something we should be looking at as part of a cooperative strategy as outlined a few years ago in the strategy that the Navy people came up with?
Well, that's a great question, Eagle One, and I'm actually much more hopeful in this regard than I was, say, 4 or 5 years ago. I think a breakthrough moment with respect to U.S. cooperation and the chance for even greater cooperation with the U.S. and its Pacific and Indian Ocean partners occurred in 2010. There were two dramatic episodes, diplomatic episodes, that occurred in 2010, which were very favorable, I think, for U.S. interests in this regard. They both happened to occur, ironically enough, in Hanoi, Vietnam. They were ASEAN meetings, Association of Southeast Asian Nation meetings. And it was at those meetings, the July meeting was a foreign minister's meeting, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton attended that meeting. And it was at that meeting that the regional backlash against China's aggressiveness, maybe aggressive is the wrong word, but assertions, the regional backlash by these small countries against China's assertions began and came spilling out very visibly into the open. And Secretary of State Clinton was at that meeting, and she stood up for these countries, some of whom we have treaty alliances with and others who we have partnership agreements with or partnership understandings with. They wanted the U.S. They wanted to hear the U.S. standing up for them. Secretary Clinton came out vocally, stood up with them, and really put the Chinese back on their heels at that meeting. That was a big event. And it was what these countries wanted to hear. And it was a big change for ASEAN itself, because prior to that time, the ASEAN countries were sort of prideful of the fact that the U.S. was not part of the ASEAN group, and they kind of kept an arm's length relationship. But as it's become more apparent about Chinese assertiveness, that they quickly dropped that stance, and now they're very much welcoming a much larger U.S. diplomatic and now increasingly military presence around the South China Sea. And then let me just follow up by saying, in October of 2010, just a few months later, there was another meeting in Hanoi. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates appeared at that, and he repeated the U.S. message in support of these countries pushing back against China, its territorial claims in the South China Sea and elsewhere, and that was really those two meetings and events in Hanoi that occurred in July and October 2010. I think was the beginning of this pushback and the against China and it's going to result. It has resulted since then, and will continue to result in my view, increasingly close cooperation between the United States and these countries with respect to security planning and military cooperation. So I think to answer your question, Eagle One, I think the answer is that we are going to get more out of these allies. We're going to get better cooperation because we all see our common interests here.
And before I jump into my next question, you know, Robert, especially for Eagle One, I was just a kid at the time, but I think that's one thing that perhaps we didn't give enough attention to, and it takes place with the fact that we're having meetings in Hanoi where the U.S. is talking about supporting and defending and the interest of the Vietnamese in Hanoi, of all things. I think says a lot about where the world has evolved to. Plus, you talk to the people who have been to Vietnam in the last 10 years or so, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say the affection they have for the visiting Americans. Really, not everything in the future is negative, I think, when you look at where we've come in some countries and some places.
Let me just a quick footnote to what you just said there. The first Special Forces Group, which is the Special Forces Group that has responsibility for the Pacific region and out of Pacific Command headquarters and so forth. There are Green Berets now who are the sons and grandsons of Green Berets who fought in the Vietnam War that now go to Vietnam from time to time doing security force assistance with the Vietnamese Armed Forces. So that's an interesting that shows you how history evolves.
Yeah, something our grandfathers probably were thinking the same thing about the Germans, mm-hmm. to a certain extent. Kind of fleshing out from there, I always try to check my own worldview when reading these things. And when we think of China and China's Navy growing, of course, we see things from our side of the prism across the Pacific, Hawaii, Wake, Guam, the second island, the first island chain, Japan, Korea, except you know, headed right in towards, you know, Taiwan and the coast of China. But as China's Navy grows, and I know that they study Mahan and the other naval thinkers as much, if not more, than we do, as they grow and they get more deployed, are we perhaps not really getting a view of China's growth in this respect? Are they going to become more easterly focused, i.e. looking across the Pacific towards our direction? Or when you look at their real economic needs and requirements, is their growth going to push more to the west and the southwest through the sea lines of communication and, more importantly, their resource locations in Southwest Asia and Africa? And should we really be focused on that shift of influence, vice, an American-centric view straight across the Pacific?
Yes. Well, great, good question. It's hard for us to get visibility inside the Chinese planning and thinking. They're the amount of authoritative writing that comes out of the Central Military Commission and the PLA is limited. So the best we'll be able to do is observe what they're doing. It seems to me that for them to be able to fix the strategic problems that they have to their southwest in the Indian Ocean and South Asia and so forth. They first have to fix strategic problems that they have directly to their southeast, the South China Sea and the Strait of Malacca, and because that's where their coastline is. So we have heard about the string of pearls strategy, so-called strategy, where they're supposedly the Chinese are supposedly trying to establish naval outposts along the perimeter of the Indian Ocean at various points. I think it's fair to say that that is not developing as well as they might have hoped. The changes, the dramatic changes that have occurred in Burma this year and last year are an indication of one more country who is changing its mind about its over-reliance on China. This dramatic opening of Burma to the West must have been motivated by the leadership in Burma having second thoughts about its over-dependence on China. And and why, if China's supposedly the future big dog in the neighborhood, why would they make such a change? Would seem a bit illogical, but maybe the leadership in Burma knows some stuff about or has some changed views about China that maybe we should take into consideration ourselves. But in any case, that was another favorable diplomatic development for the United States, and a setback for possible Chinese basing plans to its southwest.
One of the questions, of course, is whether or not China can be reassured somehow, and maybe it's not in their psyche, or maybe it's not in our ability to do it, but be reassured that we're that in a peaceful world, there is no reason for them to worry about their sea line of communication. I know that we our last show spent a lot of time discussing whether we're in a Hobbesian, basically a Hobbesian world where you can't trust anybody, or whether there is different states of, at least my view, a different state of possible peaceful coexistence with a recognition that they don't have to worry about it. Is there any sign that you've seen that which way the Chinese go? Are they just pretty paranoid about it, and where it's all Hobbesian and bloody tooth and fang and nail, or have you seen something else?
No, that's really the fundamental question. No country has benefited more from an open trading system and from the U.S. protection of the global commons and the Indo-Pacific sea lines of communication than has China. They've been a great economic and political beneficiary of the U.S. Maintenance of the global commons. So one would think that based on that tangible experience that they would also want to be a status quo power, just like the U.S. wants to preserve the status quo in the neighborhood out there. And we have so many overlapping interests, the United States and China do, very interdependent economies, financial systems, trading systems, both have interests in peaceful outcomes over possible conflicts. We both have interests in stability on the Korean Peninsula and so forth. Anyways, a long list of common interests. We have common interests on counterterrorism, common interests on counter-piracy and so forth. So with all those joint interests, you would think that the odds would be high that we could work out any difficulties rather than resorting to conflict. And I think that that's still by far the highest probability result, that there won't be conflict between the U.S. and China. But as we've learned throughout history, in order to make such an outcome actually occur, it also requires vigilance, prudent planning, peace through strength, and taking into account all the bad things that can happen and planning for them. And whenever the U.S. has done that in the past, it's gotten good results, and we should continue to think that way in the future. Now, just let me say a few more things about the view from China. Having said all those things that we have in common, there are some fundamental clashing differences with respect to U.S. goals in the region and China's goals in the region. The view from China is that China is still not a unified country, and they still have as a paramount goal unifying what they see as an ununified country. Here I'm talking about Taiwan is a major issue for them, obviously. But then also, you've talked about this on your program in the past, the so-called cow's tongue, Chinese territorial claim down into the South China Sea, which dates back to some Chiang Kai-shek Kuomintang map from the 1930s that somebody pulled out of some file drawer. But anyway, the Chinese, some Chinese leaders are asserting a territorial claim over the South China Sea, and that is just a fundamental clash with U.S. and our allies' interests in the area there. And now there's clashing territorial claims between Japan and China over Senkaku Islands. China doesn't like U.S. intelligence gathering in its maritime exclusion zone, even though the Law of the Sea Treaty and customary international law provides for that. The U.S. goals concerning democracy and human rights, the Chinese Communist Party considers those to be subversive to its interests. So we see ourselves as being a status quo power. Many in the leadership in China see the U.S. as actually being an expansionist and revolutionary power, subversive power, and maybe not something that they can live with in the long run. So, that's the setup for conflict. Hopefully, the points that of our mutual interest will outweigh those points of conflict, and we can maintain peace and stability in the region. And of course, that's the effort that everybody is going to be working on, I think, in the period ahead.
You know, interesting thing, when you look at, lack of a better phrase, the Korean near abroad, for obvious reasons, they still have significant issues with Japan over World War II. And another country that has significant issues with Japan over World War II are the South Koreans. But the incredible story, which is the post-Korean War economic growth of South Korea, to the point, you know, their shipbuilding industry is one of the best in the world. Their military is, man for man, one of the best in the world. The one thing that seems to be driving Korea and Japan to getting past some of their animosities and working better together is the concern about North Korea. And the one thing that keeps North Korea pretty much together has been either direct or indirect support from China. And, you know, everybody tries to manage the second and third order effects of inertia nations have with who are their friends and who are they not. But I've heard some people talk about China, touching on what you call, you know, unified country. A lot of people don't realize that China is not a billion plus Han Chinese. It's a multi-ethnic, multilingual country. It has a not insignificant Korean minority up in northeast China. And they see as avoiding Korean unification as a way of negating that problem for the foreseeable future. But where right now is there any gain, really, for China keeping the hermit kingdom of North Korea where it is right now?
Well, I think it's a buffer zone. They look at it as being a buffer zone between significant and effective modern mobile ground forces of the South Koreans and the United States in South Korea. The Chinese don't want those ground forces and tactical air forces closer to their border. That may be kind of an obsolete notion in 2012, but just due to inertia, established norms that were established in the 1950s, that's probably the way they see it in Beijing.
The historian who's in our chat room, B.J. Armstrong, has earlier posed an interesting question about comparing the Chinese claims in the South China Sea with the U.S. Monroe Doctrine. And I must confess that my recollection of the Monroe Doctrine is a little weak, but I'm familiar with the nine-line claims of the Chinese. Have you got any thoughts along those lines?
Well, there's no comparison in terms of the importance of global commerce between the Caribbean in the 1830s and the South China Sea over the last 50 and in 2012 and in the decades ahead. The South China Sea, the Caribbean was not that important or was of declining importance to the great powers in Europe in the mid-1800s. There were no significant economic powers in that region. Even the U.S. was a minor economic power at that time. The situation with respect to the South China Sea and its importance to the global economy today is of a totally different character. 50% of all the global seaborne commerce in the world today flows through the South China Sea. 80% of Japan and South Korea's crude oil imports flow through the South China Sea, and there are so many more countries who are rising economic and political powers whose fortunes are tied to the South China Sea, just make it such a center of gravity for the global economy that there's really no comparison to what the Caribbean meant either today or back in the 1830s.
When I was reading through your latest article that came out the 20th, you mentioned before the general's dystopia, which, by the way, if anybody goes to the Small Wars Journal link that I have, or the foreign policy link, you can tap into the archive there and see the latest one. Though you don't directly address this issue, but one thing that came to mind as I was reading this that will help hopefully tap into your Marine Corps background a bit is, you know, we can always talk about balance and making sure nobody gets excited, but sometimes history throws you a curveball, and if there ever was an occasion, we would have to shift a lot of military resources across the Pacific You still have to do the balance of that via heavy strategic sea lift and, of course, our amphibious forces and our carrier strike groups. But one trend that we have seen is our Navy shrinks that I wanted to touch base with you a bit. When you look at the anti-access, anti-denial weapons that, as you mentioned in the article, you know, the technology is really not that complicated for people to get hold of, to reverse engineer. The Chinese are great reverse engineers. And when you look at how our fleet is constructed, especially a big concern of mine for years has been our bias towards the economically logical sense of large amphibs. Big ships, big capability, carry lots of Marines, lots of equipment. But with that, you have fewer numbers, and you're really taking on a lot of battle risk in that what in previous generations, a loss of one or two ships would be a tactical or perhaps an operational problem to be able to complete your tasks that you've been outlined. But when you have such large amounts of assets spread so thinly among a few high-value units that a loss of one or two ships can quickly become a strategic issue. Have we really taken a good, hard, battle-focused view on how we are allocating our assets so much in so few units?
That's a great question. And my article, as you mentioned, the last one I wrote came out on Friday at Foreign Policy, tries to get at this question. And I don't have the answers for it, but I do think that the Pentagon planners, and everybody who has interest in this around the country and around the world should be thinking about these very issues, about what the dispersion of precision military power, precision munitions, and so forth, it should mean to force structure design, both for the Navy, but also all the services. You know, on this point, with respect to discussing the Navy's problems in the Pacific, Andrew Erickson, the great mind at the Naval War College, has described the Chinese Navy or their naval strategy is sort of an anti-Navy strategy. It's really based on missile warfare and being able to dominate, attempting to dominate the sea from the land through through the delivery of ballistic missile, long-range ballistic missile, and long-range cruise missile strikes. Directed by you know, a sophisticated intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, command and control network, and this is the challenge for the Navy. And the question is what force structure is going to be appropriate in the future to meet this challenge. And the Chinese are working on it now, but they're not going to be the last ones to work on it as the technology price cost comes down and disperses to greater availability, the U.S. will be facing this missile challenge everywhere along the global commons, not just in the Western Pacific. So getting back to my article on the Navy's problems in the Pacific, discussed or surmised one scenario, and that is that that the most valuable ships in the Navy might not be able. It might be too risky for them at some point to be able to operate routinely inside the missile zone that the Chinese or other missile powers may be able to establish at some point, and that the U.S. at that point would only be able to operate expendable, low-cost expendable ships in order to pursue its forward presence strategy, and that might mean the LCSs might be the only ones to operate routinely inside the missile zone, because we have to presume that the adversary gets the first shot in a surprise attack, and you wouldn't want to have your best but vulnerable capital ships, most prestigious ships, vulnerable on a day-to-day basis. So the issue is can the U.S. Sustain a forward presence strategy that reassures its allies and keeps them on side and keeps them from splitting off and cutting side deals with adversaries if it cannot operate safely its most prestigious assets alongside or cooperatively with those allies that it's trying to reassure. And so this is why the forward presence strategy might be at risk. And if it is, then U.S. planners and weapons program managers and so forth will have to think long and hard about what adjustments to doctrine and programs might have to be made in order to fix these problems.
Another recent article in Foreign Policy, and it's going to sound like I've done nothing but read Foreign Policy for the last couple of days, but was the one that Toshi Yoshiharan and Jim Holmes put out about the next arms race, which deals with the rise of the submarine forces of the various allies we have in the in South East Asia. Have you looked at that? And do you have any? It seems to me that of all the weapons, the systems that can operate safely in the environment that seems to be being created out there, that the submarine forces, the Japanese, the Singaporeans, and a few other countries are working on would be pretty viable vessels to use for that. Have you looked at that problem?
Well, I can't say enough good things about Yoshihara and Holmes. Their great book, Red Star Over the Pacific, which discusses the developments of the PLA Navy, is required reading for anybody who's interested in these subjects. And Jim Holmes, he writes frequently also at The Diplomat, which covers Asian developments in all different forms, diplomatic, military, and so forth. So, and at The Diplomat and elsewhere, they have talked about the looming submarine arms race in the region. I think it's a pretty much a no-brainer for countries that find themselves trying to catch up in terms of naval power to go to submarines at the top of their shopping list, because they are available. There are several very good manufacturers. The Germans and others make good Scandinavians. They make great or very good diesel electric air independent propulsion submarines, and they put surface forces at risk right away. So it should be no surprise that countries in the Western Pacific are our allies and partners. Who are now trying to catch up with this emerging Chinese threat are turning to submarines right away. And this is I discussed this in another article on this theme that I wrote in Foreign Policies a few months ago, where I discussed the air-sea battle doctrine that the Pentagon has been working on for some time. And once again, this issue of If we can't operate surface forces inside the missile zone, and if our forward bases, say on Okinawa, Japan, and possibly even Guam itself, are under threat of suppression from missile strikes, than what's left in terms of military power. It's stealthy platforms. Stealthy platforms, we're talking about submarines, obviously, and then long-range strike assets, B-2, and then the follow-on next-generation bomber and the Navy long-range U-class drones. So we could have those strike assets that could survive inside the missile zone, and maybe that will be the future force structure. But, gosh, you know, that's not a force structure that's going to provide reassuring presence to allies, and it's not going to be a force structure that's going to continue on with the forward presence strategy. How we as a Navy, as a Pentagon, and as a country are going to fix these dilemmas really is a great problem for strategists to think through and for all of us to solve.
That's a perfect lead into the question I wanted to bring up, Robert. And I don't want to jump down the UCAV rabbit hole. I have been always one of the drone skeptics. I think they're a great tool, a great asset. UCAV in many respects is a recallable TLAM that has a couple other little special assets to it. But it's always hard to say I have an answer to your question when it is all just theory at this point. I always think there's a lot of technology risk when you do that. But when you look at our strike force right now, back in the Cold War when we had an actual Red Banner fleet to contend with, we had to think about the safety that you get from a distance to your target. The closer that you get to your target, the closer you get to shore, the greater there is a threat to your fleet and its ability to project power ashore, vice just trying to defend itself. And as a byproduct of that, we had a pretty robust deep strike capability to meet this, and also fleet air defense ability with the A6 and the F-14. We had organic tanking capability to go even further if needed. But with the fall of the Soviet Union, we seem to have lost that, and we got very spoiled in the fact that I don't call buddy tanking organic tanking, because it's really parasitic. You're taking away your strike ability in order to do buddy tanking. So we really don't have organic tanking with our F-18, which is in essence a light fighter, as will the F-35. So we have lost our defense in depth and our ability to strike deep with our TAC air dominated by these light fighters. Have we made a mistake, and there's really nothing on the drawing board now to really try to address this, but do we need a fundamental rebaselining looking at our ability to conduct strike from distance to mitigate the anti-access, anti-denial threat that is still in the process of developing? It's not with us in volume at this point. Or are we going to have to find other paths to mitigate that threat beyond throwing everything in the UCAV hope basket?
Well, yes, I do think we're overcommitted. The Pentagon is overcommitted to the F-35 program. It doesn't have enough range to provide the utility needed for the vast distances in the Pacific and Asian theater. And so, yes, we need longer range strike systems for the problems that we have in Asia Pacific. And I think this is that realization, and other factors are the reason for the development of the air sea battle doctrine, or the forces that brought that about. And air sea battle doctrine has a lot of problems with it, but it also can provide solutions. I think it's been misunderstood. I think it started out as just a common sense way for the two services to cooperate together with respect to tactics, where they both bring unique skill sets to a problem, and they achieve synergy between them from the unique things that they bring together. So, for example, with respect to the range problem and the tanking problem, the U.S. Air Force can provide long-range airborne early warning and great tanking skills in support of a carrier strike group, and so both are made better off by cooperating together and bringing their unique skill sets to the problem. And but I think the solution to long range strike is going to be a combination of things. The Navy has TLAMs. The next generations are going to be great missiles. It's something that those TLAMs launched from submarines and surface ships. That's something that the Air Force doesn't have, but it can support Air Force missions. The next generation bomber is going to be able to do things that support Navy missions. There's a lot of synergy that can be created through the two services merging and cooperating with their capabilities.
Well, Robert, I'm sure we could talk forever on the Pacific problem, but let's get a little more personal with you. Let's tell us a little bit about Small Wars Journal, how it got started, what you people are up to over there, and it's one of my favorite read places. But how'd you get the idea, and where are you headed next with it?
Well, I take zero credit for launching it. That credit goes to Dave DeLegge and Bill Nagel, who started this many years ago. They worked together at Quantico. It started off as a urban combat publication back more than 10 years ago, and then moved into the counterinsurgency and irregular warfare space later on. And it's just been a huge success with a wide readership and a great contributor base of people writing for it now. The areas of interest that it covers have expanded now too, onto whole of government issues, strategy issues, procurement, and so forth. I think it has a great past, but it also has a great future. And I encourage all your listeners to regularly stop by. And there's just a constant stream of new and interesting articles and material there, contributed by a wide variety of people from all the branches, people writing from the field, from the combat zones, from other countries. Our allies contribute to it. It's a great thing, and so many other people besides me get the credit for that.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that. Small World Journal is it's a great publication. I think you have a great stable of writers there. And for people that live on Twitter, sometimes you can get overwhelmed because you pop them out on Twitter one after another. But it's always a good place. If I'm looking for a post idea, I can go up there and look through the latest tweets. Hey, I really appreciate you taking the day, Robert, to be with us for an hour. It's been a real quick hour, a real enjoyable conversation.
Well, thank you very much. It went by really quickly, and hopefully you can have me on again, and we can continue the conversation.
Yes, sir, I sure'd love to. And I want to thank everybody who is joining us live today. And again, our guest has been Robert Haddock. He is the managing editor for Small Wars Journal, and hope everybody will join us next week for another live edition of MidRats, where our guest will be Kirk Lippold, Commander USN retired, the former CO of the USS Cole. He'll be on to discuss his new book, Front Burner, Al-Qaeda's Attack on the USS Cole. Hope everybody has a great week and a great Navy Day.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.